All right, these next three sections that we're going to get into are called the post-diluvian reconstruction. Remember that after the flood, the whole world had been destroyed, so all civilizations had been destroyed. The memory of them are brought over through these eight men who are these eight people who are four men and four women who are survivors of the flood, Noah and his family. They take a cross with them, not just their own native family knowledge, whatever that was, but undoubtedly they bring with them a collection of knowledge. Whether they brought a library with them or not, or whether they just had this knowledge stored in their own minds, they brought that over. Why? Because they knew that when this flood was over, I mean, if you look at the flood myths, it's as if they survived the flood and then suddenly go, well, now what, you know? They knew when it was over with, they were going to have to rebuild the world. And that's a big task to take on. And they probably appreciated that task a lot more than Adam did when he was created, because they knew what a complex world looked like. And then after the world has been destroyed, they know that they are going to be responsible for rebuilding that world. A lot of the rebuilding that they're wanting to do is going to be a constructive rebuilding of the world. That is to say, to rebuild civilizations along a godly and constructive line. But they're not the only ones who are going to have the say in what direction civilizations develop. As they have children and their children have children and so forth, then other opinions are going to come along. Whereas the difference between the church and the world in the antediluvian period is a lot more clearly defined most of the time, it is not going to be anymore. The church and the world are going to be intermingled with one another, the faithful worshipers of God intermingled together with those unbelievers, so that Cain and Abel, or Cain and Seth, come together more and more after the flood, and then, you know, later on God is going to choose a nation and begin to form up the church out of that one. So for a good while after the flood, these developments begin to take place. We've already said that there was a pristine religious line that continues after the flood in the form of patriarchalism. But at the same time that that's taking place, the rebellion in the heart of man is still very much at work. Immediately after the flood, some people flee from the immediate area and go into remote areas and begin to set up their own settlements and colonies there. And we know that that took place in Greece. We know it took place in a lot of places, but we know it took place in Greece, because when the Ionians got to Greece, and the Ionians were chosen by God to go to Greece, the reason why we know that is because they took the name of their patriarch, Javan, or Yawan, and that's where they got their name, the Ionians, or the Yawanians. They were the first Greeks, or actually they were the second Greeks, but they were the first legitimate Greeks. And the territory assigned to them for colonization and civilization was the land of Greece in the Peloponnese, and this had been given over them for that purpose. The Bible repeatedly tells us that God scribed out the borders of the nations. The division of nations in early Genesis is a divine act. It's a divine act that is planned. I'm sure that the various families spent a long time collecting all of the stuff that they needed and boosting up their populations. And then finally, when the time came, they began to go out and colonize in different places. Those places had been found, surveyed, studied, brought back, mapped. A lot of the geography of the world was already known, so it was a matter of rediscovering places that were known before the flood. How do we know all of this? Well, you know, the Bible gives us some clues about it. It says, in the days of Peleg, the earth was divided. Y'all remember that? I think that's in Genesis either 10 or 11. In the days of Peleg, the earth was divided. this isn't continental drift. That's not what that's about. All right, there never was any such thing as continental drift. When it says the earth was divided, it means the earth was surveyed and the lands were divided or apportioned to various people. The same language is used when the land of Canaan is divided among the Israelite tribes. So the world was divided among these people. This was by divine mandate. It was worked out by the patriarchs. Preparatory work was done on it. It wasn't done immediately after the flood. It was done a couple hundred years later to give plenty of time to boost up populations, to collect all the things that were needed for starting civilization. So these civilizations were planned. They were fast start planned. They cropped up very quickly. Even the secular historians have a hard time avoiding that idea, how quickly the civilization seemed to have. That is to say, in the record, you know, if you go back in the human written records, the humanistics, if you go back, there's going to be a time when there's nothing, and then all of a sudden there are huge complex civilizations in full swing. The whole idea that you see the slow development of civilizations is speculation. There isn't any evidence of that whatsoever, not any. Now, you know, there are tells where there are little towns in there that are really primitive and everything looking. But, you know, that would be about like, for instance, saying that in 2015, the United States was just this really backwards place because we found the foundations of, you know, Jerkwater, Alabama, and we, you know, we dug it up and we see now, look, that they were not advanced at all at this time. You know, they had, you know, this junkyard over here and this, that, and the other thing. Okay, I mean, there are some towns more advanced, there are some that are not, there are some extremely complex cities. This idea that you find a non-advanced city and that what you're looking at is an earlier period, that's a big leap. That's a big leap in speculation. It was coexisting along with huge complex cities at the very same time. All right. So, you know, if you want to ignore New York City or ignore Montgomery, Alabama, or something like that, and just concentrate on these little bitty settlements that you find, and say here's the primitive state of the United States and all this kind of stuff. You know, you're trying to chronologically linearize something that is spatially linearized, okay? So it's a false way of looking at things. The truth of the matter is that, and that's one reason why archaeologists try very hard to ignore written human records, because the written records don't agree with the interpretations of archaeology, the evolutionary interpretations of archaeology. What the scientists are doing today is to try to prove development from just post-animal stage, you know, to higher and higher and higher degrees of civilization. The problem is that the human record doesn't allow that. At the earliest point that we have what we call history, we have history in full development. All right. Having said that, I mean, and the point of saying that is to say that we can tell by looking at that kind of development what it is that was carried over from the flood and what is developed from the post-flood period on. All right, let me give you a real quick example. Wheat. All right. Wheat was developed before the flood. How do we know that? And understand, this is speculation, and history is art, all right? It's not science, it's art. It's the art of fun speculation. That's what historians love to be historians for, so that they can do a lot of interpretive work. All right, but your interpretive work needs to be based on a great deal of study. It's not just something that you do out of your own set of opinions or whatever because you've watched the History Channel, or the Discovery Channel or something like that. You do this because you've studied, you've looked into the evidences and so forth, and then you do your interpretations. Wheat. I believe that wheat is an antediluvian grain. The reason why is because there is no sign of development of wheat left. Wheat is there from the beginning. So is barley. So is rice. They're all there. They're there from the very beginning. Now, we know that these grains were domesticated out of other plants. But, and one of the reasons why we know that is because many of the grains that we're dealing with have to be tended by human beings. They cannot grow in the wild. What about corn? Well, we have really good evidence that corn was developed after the flood. And the evidence is in South America and Mexico, where a grass there called Zea actually has all of the DNA of the corn in it, and that fields have been found with Zea in various degrees of development leading all the way up to maize. And so we have a good idea that corn was something that was developed afterward. For some reason or another, wheat, barley were not grown in the Western Hemisphere. We don't know why. They could have been. I mean, there's plenty of arable soil in the Western Hemisphere for wheat, but for some reason it wasn't. Maybe it was at a certain time, and then they lost the ability to do it for some reason. And there is historical written evidence that there was a period of extreme starvation throughout the Western Hemisphere. And then they were retaught how to do civilization later, which probably is one reason why Western Hemisphere lagged behind the Eastern Hemisphere. But this corn was developed probably in Central Mexico or Mesoamerica somewhere, but probably somewhere around Central Mexico, and was traded for hundreds of years, hundreds and hundreds of years, back and forth until it spread all over the Western Hemisphere, all of both North and South America, and became the staple food everywhere in the Western Hemisphere. And it didn't grow. This kind of corn grew nowhere in the Eastern Hemisphere. And so that's why we believe that it is a post-diluvian grain that was. And the one thing about corn is that it absolutely is impossible to sustain corn in the wild. It has to be cultivated. It has to be planted by human beings. All right, that's the only way that it can be cared for properly. Otherwise, it will die out and turn back into what it was before. So the same is true of knowledge. Think about the Aborigines for a minute in South America, Australia. They have this ingenious weapon called a boomerang. Did they invent that boomerang in their present state? I mean, you just have to think about that for a minute. Here they have bows and arrows that they use to hunt ground animals and so forth. Their culture for hundreds, maybe even into the thousand years, their culture has been totally subsistence culture, completely hunting and gathering. And somebody wants to try to convince me that these people had the time to work out all of the fine tunings of the science of aerofoil. Okay? A boomerang is a beautiful example of aerodynamics. It is an extremely complex instrument. And so these hunter-gatherers, in their spare time, did research and development, experimentation and failure, all right, until they found success in shaping this thing until they had a perfect airfoil. All right? I don't think so. As a matter of fact, throwing sticks, which is just another form of the boomerang, is found in higher civilizations and has been for a long time. Where did that boomerang come from? It came from a higher mind a long time ago. There was someone who understood aerodynamics much better than their descendants and taught them by craft how to do it. They never understood the aerodynamics. Why would they even go there? Why would they even think about the idea of making a flying weapon? Now, they might think about it, but they'd never go about doing it. Because they don't have time for that. They've got to survive, basically. So this knowledge that they had comes from a far more remote period where a higher mind was working. And they learned the craft. And the interesting thing about it is their attitude towards their craft. Their craft is a part of their ritual. While they're making the boomerang, you know what they're doing? They're doing these incantations. They have certain rituals that they're doing because they're putting the magic of flight into it. That's a kind of an odd thing. And we might say to them, hey, look, you know, we mass produce those things like I'll get out in plastic and they all fly just as good as yours do, which is probably not true, but they all fly, all right, because they have the aerodynamic principles. But the Aborigine didn't understand the aerodynamic principles. His ancestor did, but he doesn't. What he understands is there is a power that makes it fly. We understand that as a natural law. He understands that as magic. There's not a whole lot of difference between the two concepts, all right? And so he thinks that he is infusing it into it by ritual, while at the same time, and part of the ritual is to keep him doing his craft as absolutely perfectly as he was taught to do it by his ancestors. And so in the end, what he comes up with is an instrument that works. It works very well. But he doesn't know why, all right? All he knows is the craft. Where did the knowledge of aerodynamics come from? It came from a much, much more remote time. It was worked out some other time and passed on past the flood. So what we're going to see is a high degree of intelligence, and that high degree of intelligence begins to curve off over time. Over a long period of time, it curves off. And what we're seeing in modern times, basically, is we're beginning to make the upswing in the curve again. We are rediscovering things. Now, we give ourselves way too much credit. We think we're the great inventors of human history. No, we're the great rediscoverers of human history. We're simply rediscovering things that were once very well known, probably as well as we know them. Does that mean that the world once looked like our world right now? Probably not. But the world did once look extremely advanced in its own way. So, you know, we're just simply learning it all over again. Some of which has been stored in civilizations all this time and not even being used, like China. You know how China is. You know, everything was first invented in China. No, everything was stored in China. Half the things that men know were stored in China. A lot of them were stored in Chinese curio, where the Chinese never even used them because they didn't know what to use it for. Or it didn't fit into their philosophical system or whatever, and so it had to be rediscovered at some other time. We talked about patriarchalism in the early days after the flood. Let's look at the development of paganism. Now, I think that paganism was in full swing in the antediluvian period, but I believe that antediluvian paganism was probably almost exclusively celestial. I think that the sky was the first great object of worship. And that in itself would be a spinoff of some things that God said during creation. For instance, when he created the sun, the moon, and the stars, he told men what the purpose of those things were. He said they were there for signs and for seasons. All right? So there is a use in those. essentially what God is doing is giving us a great celestial clock, which is a good thing because really our calendars and our ways of dealing with time, which is extremely necessary for human labor in this world, is the matter of life and death, whether we do things at the right time or not. We have to have a standard for that, which is a worldwide standard. That's why God didn't create the world and put it in one of those little, water bubbles that you have for making snow stuff, or putting it on a pedestal or something like that. He hung it in the universe with stars all over the place, those stars having a certain reference to our planet in order for us to be able to use them for time references. And they're very reliable time references. And so the sky, the celestial, which, think about it for a minute. Man sins. You're an unregenerate man. You really don't understand the spiritual world because you don't have the Spirit of God in you. You've got a dead spirit. Your reference is almost completely to the earth. How are you going to understand heaven when you've got all these sons of God running around talking about heaven and stuff? How are you going to understand heaven? Well, it's up, all right? So you're going to look up, and you're going to see up there sun, moon, stars at night, things like that. You know that God's given a purpose for those things. The purpose for them is to be references for times and seasons, for the sun to rule day, which is one of the reasons why the sun has become the great god of most paganism, because God said the sun to rule the day. He didn't mean it that way. He didn't mean for them to use the sun as an object of worship. He just simply is saying that it is the great enlightener of the day, the moon to rule the night. And that is very strongly embedded in pagan thought. So what do you do with the sky? What do you do with the sky? Well, the first thing you do is you look up at night and you notice that there are things moving up there. And if you look long enough, you're going to see that they're moving in a circle. And if you look even longer, you're going to find out that somewhere in the middle of all that, there is a fixed point. And everything seems to be circling around that fixed point there. And so you're going to represent all of that as if it is a great big wheel. And that fixed point there is a hub. And around which this whole wheel is moving, so you'll see motion there, which looks like life. Motion and life, they're very much akin in the human mind, and so you'll be again to ascribe certain power to that because of those things. Also, when you study it and study it in the right way, it gives knowledge to you as if that knowledge is coming down to you from the sky. The knowledge it gives to you is, for instance, the summer and the winter equinox, the vernal and the autumnal equinox, the solstices of summer and winter, the ability to categorize various months because of the phases of the moon. It's going to lend to you knowledge in geometry, knowledge in mathematics. This is going to be translated down to the earth in surveying and being able to do architecture, all kinds of things like that. And the next thing you know, you've got sciences coming up, mathematics coming up, you've got land surveys, the ability to apportion out private property. You're going to have litigation coming out of property rights and on and on and on and on. And where did all that come from? Well, it just sort of fell down from the sky into our minds. It influenced us. The word influence means the fluids that come down from the stars to us and affect the fluids within us. All right? An ancient idea that goes all the way into the medieval period. So there's a lot of power up there. Just by observation, there's a lot of power. They're going to turn that into a religion, and we'll talk more about that religion as we go along, but it is the celestial religion. It's a very high religion, and immediately it takes on experts to be able to deal with this religion. As a matter of fact, the separations between types of people probably begins in the priesthood of the celestial sphere, because not everybody can understand that kind of knowledge. It takes a lot of study to be able to, you know, to understand the motions of the stars and the planets and all of those things, and what those things possibly mean, and how they can be used in society. But it's very useful knowledge. Right off the bat, all right, you're a king in a city-state somewhere, and you live at a certain latitude and longitude on the earth, and it's very important for you to understand, for the administration of your city-state, when it's time to plant crops, when it's time to harvest those crops, when it's time to do pruning at just the right time for the next year's crops on various things. In other words, you need to really be able to divide the year up into as accurate measures as you possibly can that are going to be regular from year to year to year. And so to do that, you need some people who really just dedicate all of their lives and all of their study to watching the relative motion of the earth to the celestial sphere. That's very important for you to do that. And you're going to have the kind of instruments that you need to do that, which is why it should not surprise us at all when we go traipsing around through old ancient grounds and we run across effigies in the shapes of rings and standing stones here and there, and hinges, and scratchings in long scratchings in the plains, and all of these odd looking buildings that are oriented to the compass and to the star Sirius or to the North Star, or that the phases of the moon actually, you know, these mandalas that are often found that actually show the track of the sun throughout the year, or the phases of the moon, things like that. And you find those all over the place. They're all over the world. Why would they be all over the world? Because every latitude, every longitude has to have its own calendar. You can't have it just for one place. You're going to have to have reliable calendars and reliable tracking devices for time in order to divide the year out in different latitudes and longitudes all over the world. So it's no surprise that we should go around the world and find pyramids and mounds and effigies and strange thises and thats all over the place. How'd they get there? Most of the time, the indigenous people there will say, we don't know, it always was here. Most of the time, that's probably true. Because probably somebody came there in advance of a civilization, put their calendars and their location markers there so that they could find this place. When they're there, they already know their calendar. They know what time of the year it is. They know when it's time to put the crops in. They know when exactly what they're supposed to do at the time of the year when they get there. So they were already there when they got there. They were put up by these surveyors, these great hunters, these Heraclean men and their crews that went from one place to another doing these surveys before they came back. And so that's more than likely where these came from. That wouldn't account for everything like pyramids and stuff like that, but things like Stonehenge and various effigies, maybe the Nazca scratchings effigies and certain buildings or orientations of buildings or things. In Talos Pueblo, there's a bunch of buildings over there that are astronomically oriented. And if you study the buildings very carefully, they're not for living in. I mean, the way the rooms are arranged, many of the rooms you can't get in, except you have to climb over the wall to get into the room. But if it had a ceiling on, I mean, if it had a roof on it, you wouldn't be able to get in most of these rooms. It probably wasn't made to live in. It was probably made to be studied in order that you would be able to orient yourself to the stars and form your calendar up and things like that. So it's not unusual to find these kind of things. A lot of that was being done. The knowledge of this, it had already been developed. It comes over the flood, and after the flood, men began to work with this. So man, he starts with a very high degree of knowledge, which is going to go down over time. Unfortunately, some of these institutions that he uses here, he's going to be turning into religion. And cosmology is a powerful thing. Therefore, it has a powerful effect on the mind and on the human psyche. So therefore, we're going to begin to think in terms of celestialism, in terms of heavenly bodies, astronomy, astrology. Astrology is basically where you've taken astronomy and you've attached spiritual meanings to it. The relationships between the sky and the earth become a lot closer. They become more influential. And so astrology becomes a part of human thinking probably very early. Prognostication coming from the study of the motions of heavenly bodies comes along very early. A whole school in Mesopotamia, which filled up an entire city called Babylon, called the Chaldeans. And these Chaldean magi, which is where we get our word magic, these Chaldeans did nothing but study the stars. The stars, all right? Whole books were written on it. The Almagest by Ptolemy was written on that, which, by the way, once the medieval men knew that that such a book had existed, they didn't rest until they found the Almagest. And when they did, it made it possible for Columbus to come over here from the old world to the new world, because now they had ancient star charts and were able to triangulate navigation. So these are powerful thoughts, very powerful ideas, which are going to very easily become religious. Whenever man is struck by something profound, it becomes sacred to him. And once it becomes sacred to him, it's not far away from being a part of his religion. All right? Then there was another kind of religion that rose up alongside of celestialism after the flood, I think. I don't know, and I could be wrong about this, but this one may have developed some before the flood, but I don't. If it did, it probably died out almost thoroughly and then resurfaced again after the flood. It's one of the most natural religions in the world. In fact, we all have to be careful of this in our own family circles and family reunions and so forth, because family is a very powerful institution, and family is a powerful enough institution to start a religion. And religion did start in families. One form of pagan religion that started in the family was ancestor worship. Ancestor worship comes along really early. And if you think about it, it's the most logical thing in the world, all right? I see people in the South doing it all the time. And they don't have to wait three or four generations to deify their ancestors. They can do it in one generation. All you've got to have is one good half-paid preacher to get up there and pronounce that your uncle, who was a drunk all of his life, is in fact in heaven right now, and that the circle will not be unbroken by and by. So the bottom line is that we have a natural tendency to do that. What does our memory do with our ancestors, okay? It cleans them up. Just washes them up real good. Gets rid of all their stink and smell and everything like that and turns them into saints. So you all get together at a reunion, everybody wants to remember Grandpa so-and-so. And he never did anything but good his whole life long. Well, is that really true? I mean, if we go back and rewind and take a real look at the life of this guy, is that really true? Well, maybe in some cases it is, but it can't be that many times, okay? everybody's grandfather wasn't a saint. All right? I know mine weren't. One of them was maybe better than the other, and the other one just flat wasn't. Now, I don't want to speak ill of the dead, but see, there's a problem there. Nobody does. And so we can dress anybody up, and once we do, our memories allow us in time to actually raise them up to a deified saint. We first take them as an ordinary human being, forget all of the bad things that they've ever done, sanctify them, and then little by little, they might actually be able to rise up into the family pantheon. Idols, I am about 99% sure, started in houses. I don't think that idols began in temples. Temples were something that were invented to hold idols. The idols were already there. Probably the idols were, okay, where does Grandma put all the pictures of all her family members if she's living in an old, old house? Over the fireplace, okay? You know, you go to the hearth, and there they are all over the hearth, and then they're hanging up all around there and everything like that. It's like a shrine. It's a very old thing. It's been done and done and done for a long time. The Lares. The Lares were the hearth gods. They're idols that were set up on the hearth. And the hearth in the household was the original TV set. All right? That's one reason why probably we're so attracted to a rectangle with lights going off, all right? Because it's just like a fireplace. And there's a fireplace. And by the way, fire is spirit, right? I mean, it's moving, it eats, it breathes, it's some living thing, but you can pass your hand through it, so it's ethereal. So it's spiritual. It warms up the statues and makes them feel like they're alive. The lights play on them. You do your augury in front of that and your prayers. It's a religious experience, all right? People spend a lot of time before the hearth and before the little gods before the hearth. Who were who? They were little representatives of their ancestors, all right? Now, you let that go long enough, and think about that. Okay, one generation, he has his ancestors up there and he's doing this, you know. The next generation comes along and, you know, they decide, I don't even know who these are. Poof, throw them away, and then add a couple in that he likes. And this shifting around from generation to generation begins to form a little pantheon right here. And, man has this instinct inside of him that it's not good enough just to do things on the family level. It has to begin to turn into something a little bit more institutional over time. So, you know, you start thinking of these as being alive and you respect them and you know that they're spiritually somewhere and you're praying to them and all this kind of stuff. And now we need to put a little house around them, all right, enclose them into a shrine. And then they're not quite big enough. These are just little bitty things. We need to increase their size and the size of their house, and the size gets bigger and bigger. How big did the Lares get? Well, you know, you go to Egypt and you look at the Colossi of Ramses over there, which are, you know, some 75 feet high. The great temple of Karnak, the huge colossal statues that are all over the world. You're trying to make them look like they're alive again. Now, we know this is true because some societies actually would go and dig the dead back up again and redress them once a year and talk to them and, you know, have them sitting at the table with them while they had a meal, and then they'd take them back and bury them again, you know? I mean, this is man. His orientation to death, on the one hand, he's dealing with it. On the other hand, he wants to try to bring things back to life again and so forth. Deify his ancestors. They're better than I am. I mean, that was a view that they had. And this part of the religion, this familial and provincial part of the religion, is on its own for a long time, while you have more of an institutional, celestial religion that's being practiced by kings and priests and things of that sort. At some time, these began to move together. These religions began to come together in the temple and the city and the tower and the priesthoods and all of these kinds of things. And so the great institutional state religions began to come out of these two forces right here. All right. The one is more oriented to the sky. The other is more of a patriarchal and homey type of thing. The same thing happened in the earth religions, where the familial portion of it comes together with the pastoral portions of it. And those fuse together into a slightly different, into somewhat of a different form of paganism. And then the overlaying and conquest of those with one another kind of morphs them into different other kinds of patriarchal, matriarchal, of sky and earth at the same time, these syntheses of the two kinds. You see this take place as history is going along. While everything is separated out, everything stays nice and clean. It always stays the same. But when city-states start taking over other city-states, then they begin to mingle together their religion with theirs. They don't destroy the other one. They just fuse them together for the most part. One overlays and dominates the other one, but the other one is always there in a substrata. And then when the great conquests start taking place, then one is coming down against the other, but still it doesn't annihilate it, because that's the thing about human pagan religion. It's very malleable. It fits in together. It meshes in. When the Dorians took over Greece, they brought a patriarchal celestial religion and laid it on Greece, which was pastoral matriarchal. The exact opposite. And what did it turn into? It turned into Hellenism. Hellenism is a combination of those two. The Hellenistic religion, the great Olympian religion that you know from Edith Hamilton so well, is the combination of these two kinds of religion coming together, because the patriarch and the matriarch comes together, because the earth and the sky comes together, all right? And they fuse together into a single system. And that's a complicated system. And it gets more and more complicated and harder to track. It takes more and more experts to be able to sort out all of its meaning. Over time, universities and seminaries had to raise up in the ancient times in order to train priests in various lands. One of them was in Pergamos in Asia Minor. Another one was probably in Etruria, where the Etruscans lived later on. There probably was one in Babylon as well. These were great centers of learning. Memphis had one. Not Memphis, Tennessee. Memphis, Egypt. Great seminaries for learning. And, you know, if you wanted to learn to be the priest of your religion, you didn't have to go to Egypt to do it. You could go to Asia Minor to learn it. Or you could go to Etruria to learn it. So there were these places where you would learn these things. Great places of learning. That helps you to understand a little bit when you start reading the book of Daniel, what Daniel's position was when he was made the head of the Chaldeans. He was actually the president of the great school of the Magi. Now, how did he do that and maintain his righteousness? Well, he, you know, handed that over to God, and I'm sure he handed over all of the practice to the Magi to do and everything, but he was elevated to this incredibly high position in those schools. It wasn't because he was because he himself had learned expertness in those fields, but it was because his power, that is God's power in him, superseded that of all of the Chaldeans. And I'm sure he had an arrangement with the emperor. I only worship God. I don't worship all this stuff. But officially, he was still in that position as one of the great presidents of Babylonia. All right. And to do that and maintain your righteous standing before God, which he did. Because that was the story of Daniel's life. I'd like to spend some time talking about that. But that's the story of Daniel's life, is how a boy was put in public school and survived. All right? Now, that certainly is not a motif for putting your children in public school. And I would not use that by any means whatsoever. But this boy was put in the worst schools that you can possibly imagine, statist schools that you can possibly imagine. God was with him, and when it was over with, he maintained and increased his righteousness before God. All right, got to wind down. So these are the two directions that paganism is beginning to run in. What did I do in my glasses? There they are beginning to run in. Things are going to break down from that, and later on we'll talk about this. They're not going to stay that way, this archaeo-paganism. There are great changes that are going to take place in the ancient world, and it's going to have to morph into something else. And what it's going to morph into is what we call neo-paganism or statist paganism. And so we'll get into that later, but I just want you to know where we're going. Because these ways of thinking work in the days of these people. Get that down. These ways of thinking work in the days of those people. You know, the circular reasoning of man, the tight circular reasoning of man, it may be fallacious, but in a local area, it works. The medieval synthesis worked just fine for a long time. But as outside knowledge begins to come in more and more, it has to adjust to these changes that takes place. Great transmigrations going on all over the world. People overlaying people in migrations, in conquests, civilizations dying out from plague, another one coming in and taking over their old cultures, the displacement of people because of migrations that are going on, and there were migrations were going on and on, mass migrations were going on and on and on for a long time in ancient times and disturbing things. That was God's way of stirring things up and keeping things from stabilizing, all right? And it kept the world going and without corrupting down to any faster than it actually did. It wasn't until man settled down that the corruption really started to come in. So God just kept stirring the world up for a long time. Keep men moving, keep moving, keep moving. And but this did things to people's thoughts. It roiled thoughts up, and it made it and it made it difficult for them to find their equilibrium and their stabilized systems. But over time, they began to do that, and certain changes began to take place in the world. But one of the things that they carried with them through this whole thing was an idea of dualism, which I believe that the idea of dualism comes from the proto idea of heaven and earth. There's your first dualism: heaven, earth. Heaven, earth. And that dualism is the commanding dualism over all dualisms. What is a dualism? Well, it's basically the belief in two ideas that are at odds with one another and yet coexist. And that these make up reality. Reality isn't a singularity. Reality is dualism. It is the combination of opposites. All right. It is it's illustrated in the Tao. The Tao is that lunar symbol that you see in the Far East. Which has a dark side and a light side to it, which represents the two principles of yin and yang, the passive and the active. And this is the probably most raw view of dualism. And together these make up reality. And you're supposed to do something with that in your life. You're either supposed to fight against it, or you're supposed to join it, or you're supposed to find the balance in it, or you're supposed to whatever in it, whatever your civilization teaches you you're supposed to do. But everybody believes in this dualism, all right? And everything is divided up in the dualism. Good and evil, heaven and earth, sky and ground. war and fertility, patriarchy and matriarchy, celestialism and provincialism, spirituality and corporality, terrestrialism and abysmalism. These are dualisms that make up, these are the particular dualisms and many more that make up our perception of reality. Now hang on to that idea, because that idea right there, the idea of dualism, is a philosophical idea. It's not a mythological idea. It's a philosophical idea. There was a time with the when the mythopoeic man thought philosophically without knowing it. In fact, he always did. His philosophy was a priori. He didn't really even understand he was doing it. It was his background. Man never was non-philosophical. He always was philosophical. Just like he was always technological. He was always scientific. He was always logical. He was always rational. He was always inductive. He was always deductive. He didn't discover these as he went along. He was always those things. But he hadn't categorized it yet. He hadn't studied that in himself yet. Mythology was good enough. It worked. It was a blatant way of fighting against God. Now, as civilization begins to move on, man begins to abstractize things more instead of trying to deal forthrightly with interpretation of physical universe. He begins to make things more and more abstract. And that's when he's going to change his direction.